All right. Well, thank you. Thank you all for being here and letting me talk and let me talk history. Have people say, oh, you're talking today? I said, yeah, but it's history. And, you know, as a historian, you get used to apologizing for your field, which is unfortunate because I think if you could contain everything that I know, I'd say about, you know, a lot of it has come from just people around me and that sort of thing, but a fair amount of it has come from learning from our brothers and sisters in the past, and as they've challenged me to think more carefully, more diligently about what I believe, and so hopefully I'm going to share that with you this afternoon. The agenda here is we're going to talk about some things I just want to just point out early on that I think is important to point out. And then we'll talk about discipleship and entry into the early church. By the early church, I mean the first century, second century, third century. All right. So Pentecost until, let's just say, the 400s, around there. Okay. How they brought people into the church. And then I'm going to talk about Macrina. Macrina, how many of you have heard of a woman named Macrina? Oh, my. You need to know about Macrina. I just learned about her just in the last 6 months. I'm like, man, this is an amazing person. So we're going to learn about Macrina, because a lot of what you believe, I shouldn't say a lot, but a fair amount of what you believe, yeah, Macrina had a step in that, had a hand in that. You just don't know it. So Macrina, and then we'll talk about discipleship among our cousins today. People are like our spiritual cousins today, how they do discipleship and the effect that it's had. And then I'm just going to run down a list of other people that you might want to look up and think about yourself. So first things, one, I am not going to agree with, I don't agree with everything that I'm going to say today, right? I never agree with everything that I read in history. That's not the purpose. The purpose of doing history is not to find agreement. The purpose of reading history is not to be told what to do or what to believe. The Bible does that for us. But what history does, number one thing, it humbles me is I realize that my own perceptions of my faith in the world maybe are just like my own perceptions of faith in the world. There might be actually better ways of understanding things out there. So what humbles me is I realize just the godly, brilliant people who have thought things differently than I do. So I'm not going to agree with everything. I'm just going to present it. I'm going to talk about it, and you're not going to know whether I think this is a good idea or not. Okay? But I don't want you to walk out of here saying, well, Fred said that we ought to do this and that. I said no such thing. I described how people in the past have done something. Okay? I am inspired by most of this. Even when I disagree with it, I'm inspired. All right? It challenges me, and I think, wow, why would they do that and I do it this way? Maybe, I don't know, am I really doing this right? What does the Bible say? They interpret it differently. Wow, right? And maybe at the end of the day, I'm still disagreeing with them, but it still challenges me, right? So I'm just going to describe it, and then you do the sorting of the good and the bad. What I'd really love for you to do is, at the end of this, you have no idea what I think is the right thing or the wrong thing, but you walk out of here, and because I haven't told you what to think about this stuff, you go out and you have conversations on your way home. You have conversations about, well, the early church did this way. What do you think about that? And so if I tell you what to think, I'm afraid it's going to shut down conversations, or you'll start arguing with me rather than, right? I mean, in a nice way. I mean, you'd be like, well, I don't think Fred meant that. Hey, whatever. Forget me. It's this stuff that's the most important stuff. So anyway, I just wanted to say that first of all. So discipleship and entry into the early church. This is a baptismal. And I realized when I was going through this few minutes ago, I forgot to look up the date on this. I think when I found this, it was like, not when I found this, but when I, if I'm remembering this correctly, this is from the 400s. I believe this is the 5th century baptismal, all right? Anybody know why this could not be a 3rd century baptismal? I guarantee you this is not a 3rd century baptismal. Public, yeah, you're on the right track. You said it. They had no churches. Christianity was illegal, so you don't have this kind of thing until it got legalized in the 300s. So I know there's at least the 300s. I'm pretty sure there's the 400s baptismal. All right, so let me explain to you how a baptismal worked in this kind of a setting, although I think this goes back even into the first century in terms of the basic format of baptism, okay? So not all this formality, not all this beautiful structure and all that kind of thing, but maybe at a river they would do something like this anyway. Okay, on one side you would have those being baptized. over here. All right? You'd have the converted Christians over here, the baptized Christians over on this side. Okay? There was a division. The early church had no hesitation about drawing bright lines between the unconverted and the converted. Okay? And so the converted folks are over here, the unconverted over here, those who are going to be baptized or the unconverted over here. And one by one, the baptismal candidates would approach here. Over here, the bishop would stand over here. You'd have a prayer. You would renounce evil in your life. You would recite a creed, things that you held to be true. Okay? If you've ever heard of the Apostles' Creed, historians think the Apostles' Creed was used at baptism. New Testament scholars believe that some passages in the New Testament are probably actually creeds recited by the church, and you would have to recite that. All right, who you believe God is, Jesus is, the Holy Spirit, what they did, and what they're going to do at the end. Okay, so you would recite a creed. There would be an exorcism where the bishop would pray that any evil spirits would go out of you, that sort of thing. Then you'd walk down into here. And you would almost do the same thing over again. You would recite it again. You would testify of your faith. You would commit to following God. You'd be baptized down here, okay? Then you'd come up the other side, and you would be received into the church. And you would give everybody a kiss, what we call a holy kiss. You would share a meal together, including a communion meal together, and now you are received into the church over here. All right. The reason I explain all this is because this is a big, big deal in the church, all right? A really big deal. Baptism, I think, was much bigger. They perceived, again, for right or wrong, I'm not telling you what to think of. I'm just saying, for the first few centuries, baptism was like a monumental moment in becoming a Christian, all right? It was the entry into the church. Okay? Really high value, and folks, you had to be prepared for it. You didn't just waltz up and say, you know, I've been hearing about this. I think I want to be a Christian. I think I want to be baptized. Okay, come in here. No. This was a big, big deal. All right, so in preparation for being baptized, you had to demonstrate several things. Number one, are you willing to listen to right doctrine? Are you willing to listen? Do you show a willingness to listen to the Christians around you? A couple years ago, I did this project on, you may have heard of it, the Way of Peace, right? Nonviolence. And one of the most fascinating things I still mull over is that the church would not let anybody into the church if they were a soldier. Excuse me. They would not let anybody in the church become a soldier. If you were already a soldier, you had to just promise that you will not commit any violence, and then you'd be okay. You can build roads, you can stand around, you know, and whatever soldiers did back then, but you couldn't commit violence. Or you'd be excommunicated. Okay, so if you were an unconverted person and you wanted to be baptized, you had to agree that you would not be a soldier. Okay, here's the thing that fascinated me. If you argued with them, they wouldn't baptize you. What fascinates me is they wouldn't baptize you because you were going to be a soldier. They didn't like that either. But in at least one account, they said, you know what? If you insist on being a soldier, you are not listening. You're not hearing the church. And that's a problem. So I find it fascinating. Do you show a willingness to listen? Are you teachable? Because if you're not teachable, then we can't have community, and community is really important in the early church. Okay? So are you willing to listen to right doctrine? And then do you know right doctrine? You had to spend a whole lot of time, and I didn't even have this on another slide here, but you spent up to three years learning what you had to learn. I mean, you got to know what you believe and why you believe it, okay? Which is what you would testify then before baptism, okay? And then are you willing to be corrected in your daily life? Are you correctable? Kind of like up here, are you willing to listen to correct doctrine? Are you willing to listen to correction in your daily life? And then, has your daily life changed? They want to know. Are you living as a pagan or not? If you're living as a pagan, we can't baptize you. So we need tangible, visible evidence that you are not living like the pagans around us. So you have to have a teachable spirit and a right doctrine and a right practice in a very rigorous way. All right, how were so many people brought to readiness? We're going to see in a few minutes. A lot of people came into the church this way. How do they do this? Okay, so there's a lot of discussion, and I think it's a very good discussion to have. And I'm not telling you what I think about this. But there's a discussion, how high a barrier do you have for entry into the church? And sometimes there's a feeling, you know, we have too high of barriers for entry, and we got to lower the barriers. That may be true. I'm not telling you what I think. What I'm saying in the early churches, they left the barriers really high, like really high, but then they did rigorous discipleship. What I'm suggesting is that you can deal with the barrier situation by lowering barriers or by increasing discipleship and helping people meet those barriers. All right? I'm not arguing for one or the other. I'm just saying in the early church, they said, we're keeping the barriers. Being a Christian is going to mean something powerful. And this is what we think it means. And that's a pretty high level. But then we're going to disciple people up to there. Right? That was the way they did it. Now, how do they do it? Okay, so discipleship, here is just, I'm just giving you one example. This is Bishop Cyril from the 4th century. This is just one example, all right, of many that we could talk about, of a number that we could talk about, describing discipleship. They had what is called catechumens. If you were a catechumen, you were being catechized. You're going through catechesis, okay? And what that means is you would, it was like classes for being a Christian. It was like a convert class. And you go through all the doctrine, all the practice. It was heavy-duty stuff. It could take years. Like 3 years they were making people wait sometimes. Before you really demonstrated that you knew what it meant to be a Christian and you lived it that way. Okay, so up until the final weeks, you were called a catechumen. Okay, a student of Christianity. In the last weeks, Cyril called the people in the last few weeks, it was especially intense. And Cyril called them those being enlightened. All right, so he talked about catechumens, he talked about pagans, then he talked about catechumens, and then the last few weeks, those who were just right there, ready to, you know, right before baptism, those are those being enlightened, the final enlightenment. By this time, especially in some parts of the Roman Empire, baptisms occurred on Easter, only once a year on Easter, by the bishop, and the 40 days before baptism you would fast. That's what it is. It's Lent, all right? And so this last few weeks is really intensive, but then he would also call all these people just disciples, right? These are the disciples, those learning what it means to be Christian. Now, you did have a mentor, okay? I'm calling it a mentor. I think they had a Latin term for it. I give you the Latin term, but you wouldn't understand it. Neither would I. So this mentor, whatever you want to call it, would be the one evangelizing, right? All you folks, go out there and evangelize, right? Go out and evangelize. Tell people the good news. If people responded positively, then you would bring the person who responded positively to your evangelism, would bring that person to the church leadership, okay? And you would say, this person wants to become a Christian. And at that point then, you would enter the catechize. You become one of those catechumens, right? What is interesting, and I'm not sure about this. I'd like to see if I can find out more about this. I think this was also an important stage in the process as well. Okay, so when you came to the church leadership, it signaled this person I think is serious enough about being Christian to enter this process. Does that make sense? Like, we're not going to waste our time on people who are just messing around. If you're really serious, that's where you would indicate your willingness to listen. Are you really willing? Are you really, really willing to listen? This is what the process is like. If you're really serious about this, you'll go through the process. Okay? So you would enter the process here. Now, so the mentor would bring people to the church leadership to start the process. They would also, of course, hang around with them and answer questions, provide accountability, that sort of thing. Because when they came for baptism, it was the mentor who would testify to the bishop, I've seen a life change in this person. Okay? Kind of like we do at our own baptisms, where the elder says, you know, Dad, have you seen a change? Mom, you seen a change? Sister, brother, aunt, uncle, right? Have you seen changes? Is this person changed life? I think very much like that, okay? Because they want to also, because the bishop knows about what you've learned, right? But he's not walking with you every day. So he doesn't know actually, is this stuff taking? Are you actually living this out? That's the mentor's role, is to help this person make those changes and then testify, hey, this person is living like a real Christian now. Okay? Tell the bishop, verify to the bishop that is happening. Now, the church leadership's role was to teach and train in doctrine and practice. And a lot of time was spent teaching and training in practice. You know, a lot of the things that if you get a book, let's say, on the Ante-Nicene fathers, the early church fathers, you know, if you've ever read Tertullian, if you've ever read Origen, if you've ever read Irenaeus, Ignatius, those people, tell me at least those names are familiar. Okay, good. I feel really good about that now. Okay, so if you read those things, you think, oh yeah, these were the early church theologians. Well, yeah, they were theologians, but you know what? They were pastors. And they didn't write those things that we enjoy now. They didn't write them just because they were just sitting around thinking. They were writing them as ways of teaching and leading and pastoring their congregation. At the end of the day, they weren't theologians first. They were pastors first. But to be good pastors, they had to be theologians. You know what I'm saying? So that was there. But it was always geared towards, so how do we teach this and how do we nurture the church this way? Okay, so he spent a lot of time doing that, and then, of course, teaching the creeds and making sure that the church knew who is God, who is the Holy Spirit, who is Jesus, what did he do, that sort of thing. Okay? Now, together, the church leadership doing what it did, and the congregation people doing what they did, discipling people, evangelizing and discipling people, this thing worked. If by worked, I put this here, because we can have discussion. Again, I'm not telling you this is all good or not. I'm not telling you like this is the way to do it. I'm not telling you this is the key. I'm just saying, in terms of numerically, boom! The church exploded across the Roman Empire. From less than 200, maybe 120, right, at Pentecost, roughly AD 30 or whenever that was. By AD 300, there's nobody really knows for sure, but some really good estimates that I've seen suggest that it could have been even more than 5 million people. Were they all true Christians? I don't know. Certainly some of them faded away in intense persecution, like we feed you to the bulls if you don't renounce your faith. Some of them renounced their faith. Does that mean they weren't true Christians? I don't know how to evaluate all that kind of stuff. I'm just saying, in terms of numerically, in terms of territory, this wasn't just the Roman Empire. By the end of the first century, it sure as anything looks like Christianity had reached even India. As far away as India. By 300 at this point, it had reached all across North Africa, all the way up into Europe, into India, across probably into Central Asia. Not too long after this, it probably reached Eastern Asia in China. Right? So in terms of territory, it exploded that way as well. And then, of course, in terms of influence, by the 300s, Christianity was the dominant religion. In terms of influence, in terms of cultural influence. I'm going to tell you this. No, I'm not going to tell you this. Influence. They were highly influenced. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Now, before we move on to the second piece, I just know somebody's going to ask this question. And I know that if there's three people who want to ask this question, there's probably 30 people who are like, yeah. Okay, you say, yeah, but what about you're saying this was like in the first century, they were you know, expanding out the time between statement where you want to be a Christian and baptism, right? But what about, you know, you're reading the book of Acts, it was like instantaneous baptism. Okay, my conclusion on this from reading history is that nobody knows exactly how the expansion or why the expansion took place. But the best arguments that I have seen, and what makes most sense to me, is if you look in the book of Acts, especially early on, most of the converts are Jews. This is a huge topic, but let me just say it this way. Jews were trained to look for the Messiah. They knew all about godly living. They knew all about who God was. They knew had the Old Testament scriptures. They had all these sorts of things. The Messiah comes, those who believe, boom, you're in Jesus. A Gentile comes from a drastically different place. So as the church gradually transformed from a mostly Jewish, almost entirely Jewish church into a mostly Gentile church by the end of the, but by 100, the church was probably mostly Gentile. Okay? And so the church said, hey, look, these people, they don't know anything. They don't have a clue about anything. We got to train them up in the truths of the scriptures. Okay? And then as that happened, it takes more time, right? It takes more time to learn that. I say God fears, so people say, yeah, but you know, Cornelius wasn't a Jew. No, he was, the Bible calls him this, a God-fearer. You look it up in the Bible, it calls him a God-fearer. A God-fearer isn't just sort of like a nice little thing. Oh, no, a God-fearer is a technical term, a Jewish term that says that you have basically adopted Judaism, except you haven't been circumcised. You're just not quite willing to take that last step. So basically a Jew that just hasn't quite yielded to circumcision yet. Okay, so they were basically Jewish people in the book of Acts. Until you get to, say, Corinthians, right? So like, you know, partway through, Paul starts preaching to Gentiles, and apparently many of them didn't have training in Moses and that sort of thing. And so then they started saying, hey, let's, and so you start seeing Paul staying in a location and methodically teaching through the scriptures, teaching them doctrine, right? Spending more time teaching. Right, so I think the span between conversion and baptism, I think you can detect an expansion there even already in the Bible times. Certainly by the end of the first century, there was a time of delay there. Okay, and then infant baptism didn't really become a thing until the late 100s. The earliest evidence we have of it is the late 100s. It was contested, and it remained contested until the 500s. Okay, so the early church grew rapidly using rigorous, comprehensive discipleship of the whole convert. This is Rodney Stark, right? So what role did discipleship play in the early church? Like everything, right? Like everything, okay? It was how it grew. If you took discipleship out of the early church, then you don't have a church anymore. It was fundamental, absolutely fundamental to the growth of the church. For right or for wrong. Okay, next, Macrina the Younger, Discipler of Saints. This is a painting of Macrina. It's just how they draw people. Don't hold this against her, okay? Macrina, this is Macrina's family. Her family is more famous. This is Bishop Gregory of Nyssa. If you read Antonicene Fathers, you'll come across Bishop Gregory of Nyssa. Bishop Basil the Great, Basil the Great, also another bishop. Man, it's been a long time since I've done that. and then this is her mom right here, also a very godly woman and discipler. This is her right here, and then her more famous brothers. Okay, so this is her closest community. She lived in the mid-300s. Her father died young, and so she and her mom ran the family estate. They were fairly wealthy. She was fairly born well-to-do with an estate, which means that she helped run the farm, basically. Run the whole household. Everybody, slaves, although then she ended up freeing the slaves. Ooh. But she had slaves. She inherited slaves and all this. She had a big estate. She helped run it, all right? Amazing person. She actually founded a monastery. Her brother Basil. You ever heard of Basil? Basil, I had some Basil last night on my... Basil, he came up with the rules of Basil. You ever hear the rules of Basil? You probably haven't, because I don't think, do we have any monks in here? I don't think so. If you're a monk, you know about the rules of Basel, okay? He came up with a rule for how you live in a monastery. He got them from Macrina, his sister. All right? He probably expanded them and all that, but he learned about the initials. And by the way, if you're like, oh, yeah, but monasteries, man, those are like the places of the devil. No, they aren't. Well, excuse me, I wasn't going to tell you my opinion. Regardless of whatever you think about a monastery, let me tell you something. If you take the monasteries out of the pre-Reformation church, if you take the monasteries out, you don't have much of a church left. Right? They were the places where almost everything happened for the average Christian, okay? And for the average non-Christian as well. Right? So they got this idea from Macrina. She was the first one to establish a monastery. She's a subject of books written by her brothers. And she was a discipler of her family, especially her brothers. So I'm going to tell a little bit about her brothers first, then I'm going to give away the secret about Macrina. Three of her brothers were bishops. They were very important in developing the Nicene Creed. Her brothers were very important in developing the Nicene Creed, which is the Trinity, right? So what you believe about the Trinity was not developed. It wasn't the idea of Macrina's brothers. The idea of the Trinity goes back to Scripture. But the language that we hold to, almost all churches in the world today are Nicene Christians. We hold to the Nicene Creed. Who developed the Nicene Creed? Her brothers were instrumental. Okay? They developed Eastern Christian liturgy, worship program. They established monasteries, founded rules for monasteries, other major theological writings and influences. If you ever come across the Cappadocian Fathers, I don't know if that rings a bell, has nothing to do with cappuccino, it's a Cappadocian. Cappadocian Fathers, Cappadocia is a region of Eastern Mediterranean in Turkey, and Basil and Gregory then were her brothers, and Gregory of Nazianzus was just a friend. Okay, so these are the famous people. If you read in the early church, these are the famous people out there getting all the headlines. But behind them, even according to them, the brothers themselves, they said, we owe so much to Macrina. Macrina taught Peter and Gregory skills, faith, and doctrine. Basil went to a really highfalutin, went away, I think, to Athens or something, to a highfalutin school. He got a really good education. And while he was doing that, she taught Peter and Gregory how to read and write, that sort of thing, the skills, faith, and doctrine. Okay, she was a conversation partner in all of their doctrinal theologizing, okay? And then when Basil came back, as young people often do when they come back from university, and he knew everything, and man, he's going to take the world, and he's going to make, literally, Macrina got in his face and said, you're nothing. Give it all to Jesus. Give it all to Jesus. You're a proud upstart. Give it all to Jesus. And it like got his attention, and he did. And his church life was then born from his sister getting in his face and saying, no. All your earthly wisdom, turn it over to Jesus. According to what they said, it was in conversation with her that they developed much of the theology that they are famous for and that has had such a profound impact even on our own belief system ourselves. Okay, they actually said it. It's not like historians are like, gee, I wonder if some of this came from Macrina. No, they actually said, we learned a lot from our sister. The brothers themselves freely and explicitly credit Macrina, their mentor and teacher, literally. They weren't just saying, oh, yes, because we all learn from our sisters, right? Any of you men who have sisters, you know that you learn from your sisters, right? I learned a lot from my sisters in an informal way. She was their formal trainer. I already mentioned her effect on Basil. They said, according to them, they said she taught through words and living example. They lived together, and so she taught them verbally, conversation, but also they just learned by watching her. This is their own description. This isn't historians. These are their thing. You know what? She was just this godly influence on our life. Gregory wrote about her last breath when she lay on her deathbed. He wrote, right up to her last breath, she philosophized, which sounds horrible today. We don't use the term philosophize. It just means thinking high thoughts, okay? Just thinking high thoughts is all he means by that. She philosophized with a lofty mind on the conviction she had formed from the beginning about the life here below. All this seemed to me to be no longer of the human order. uh, maybe a little bit of exaggeration there. But what is he saying? It's like, you know what? She's no longer human. By the time she died, she was just like, she had gone beyond humanity. All right. I will tell you that's a little bit freaky to me. But I get the point, right? I mean, he's giving a tremendous amount of respect and love towards his sister. She is the Socrates to Gregory's Plato in his book On the Soul and the Resurrection. On the Soul and the Resurrection is modeled after Plato's dialogues. You know, Plato, Socrates, the books you were supposed to read in high school, remember that? I didn't read either. But apparently in those books, had you read them, you would see that actually it's a conversation, right? Somebody's asking Socrates questions and he's responding. Macrina is the Socrates in this book. One historian wrote, Gregory views his sister as an abundant fount of theological wealth coursing through, shaping, and nourishing the Christian tradition that he has received. And Gregory wrote a book, much of what we know about her comes from the life of Macrina, written by a brother. Right? So I just put this in here because women, here's one woman, and we can talk about others as well. I had some others and I thought, well, I'm going to go too long. Very foundational in discipling others in their walk, in their Christian walk. All right, so the early church grew rapidly using rigorous, comprehensive discipleship of the whole convert. Macrina is a female example of how one person's discipling of others through close daily life teaching can have profound influence on the development of the church. Last point, conservative Anabaptists. Anabaptists began in the as the radicals. This is how historians, this is not my term for them, this is how historians call them. Radicals of the Reformation in the 1500s. The hallmark of Anabaptism was radical discipleship. Like, all out, no holds barred, kill me if you have to, I'm following Jesus no matter what. No temporizing, no compromising, I'm going after Jesus no matter what he says. They famous for two, started primarily in Switzerland, German-speaking Switzerland, Nach Folge is following Jesus. Nach is after, Folge is follow, so follow after Jesus. Okay, and Gelassenheit, which is, as I understand it, is a term that has no real good English translation, but it means something like yieldedness. So Nachfolge and Gelassenheit. We follow Jesus no matter what, wherever he goes, and we are yielding to the utmost cost if we have to. And in fact, thousands of them died because of their unwillingness to do anything but follow Jesus as they saw fit. They believe in believer's baptism. They believed in nonviolence and religious tolerance, and they also believed that there should be some space between church and state. All right, the church should not be linking up with the state. Also, the church should not be linking up with society in general. When I say linking up with, I mean, in the 1500s, all the people, everybody did. Lutherans, Catholics, Reformed, everybody believed that this is a Christian society right here. Some of this Christian society comes to church and are baptized. But we're all a Christian society. And the Anabaptists said, no, if you envision all of society as Christian, that's going to lead to various problems. Actually, there's society out there, and then there's the church. And our job is not to convert society to live the way we do. Our job is to be the church and help people leave that society and come into the church. Okay? So they put space between church and society. When I say space, I don't mean physical space. I don't mean they wouldn't talk to people. They're actually tremendous evangelists, amazing evangelists, okay? For good or for bad, I'm not saying what's right or wrong. I'm just saying they were amazing in terms of, like, you know, their activity and how much they did and all that stuff. They were really big into evangelism. But you got to come from there into here, because we're not just going to try to make everybody else do what we do, okay? So that's Anabaptism. From the 1500s, who are they today? Well, we have, these are the most famous, the most notable Anabaptists, all right? Today, this is what most people think of when they think of Anabaptists, but these actually are Mennonites, okay? Mennonites. Mennonite is a huge, huge worldwide church. The Mennonite church, as a global church, encompasses many different languages, colors, ethnic groups, just all over the place, all over the globe, okay? So these are also Anabaptists, and then, yeah, so I sent my slides to Arlen to be okay. His email back was, "Yeah, they're all okay except for slide 26." So, but we have a strong Anabaptist background to us. Okay? And in fact, if you really go back to the 1500s and you really study the Anabaptist movement in the 1500s, you'll be like, oh, that's why we do that. Oh, that's where we got that. Oh, look at that. Okay? All right, so Amish brethren, Bruderhof, Hutterites, Mennonites of all stripes, and even to a large degree, apostolic Christian. Not entirely, but we are have a strong Anabaptist influence. Not this. This is a TV reality show called Amish Mafia. And dead giveaway here, he's got a, you know, like some kind of submachine gun here. If Mennonites, if Amish would sue people, which they don't, if Amish would sue people, these people would have been sued like after the first day, because this is all a bunch of nonsense. It really is. There are non-Amish who are like, if you want us to sue them, we'll sue them. So this is just nonsense. Anyway, I thought I'd throw that in there just in case you would come across this. Because we even have some people in our church who think that Anabaptists are crazy. I had this, I really did. I had somebody tell me, I said something about Anabaptists, like, oh, Anabaptists are the crazy ones, right? I'm like, I don't know, I'm doing okay, are you? Anyway, we sort of think of people like this. And that's not it. Okay, Anabaptists and discipleship. Discipleship is absolutely, absolutely fundamental to Anabaptism. Absolutely fundamental to Anabaptism. They do some verbal teaching, okay? They will teach their kids some things. They do have sermons in their church where they talk about things. But where they really count on transferring the faith is by living together, all right? Which explains a lot of what they do, okay? In education, they develop schools for their children structured around socialization of Anabaptist values, okay? So when they run their own schools, when they run their own private schools, they arrange it so that not just what they are telling their students, but how they're living their day, they're living their values, okay? And a lot of this has to do with Gelassenheit, yieldedness, and community, okay? So if you get something, if you spell a word wrong, they'll correct you, but where they're really watching for is, hey, you're bullying. You just said something nasty to that student. Don't do that. That's wrong, all right? Hey, you're looking selfish with that. You're not sharing that. We share. Okay, and so they structure their day that way, and they have small classes where teachers have strong oversight, particular attention to social misbehavior. If you ask this, these are a couple of sociologists who studied this, and asked parents, why do you send your kids to private Amish schools? And said, because they engage in activities more directly supportive of the lives they would lead as Amish adults. Okay, and they're not talking about, well, because we want them to score high on the SAT, they're saying we want them to learn not just what we believe, we want to learn what it means to be Amish, okay? Quote from one of them, real wisdom and know-how come from experience rather than from mere book knowledge. So they do everything in, here's a German term, Gemeinde or community. They do everything in Gemeinde, community, and family. This explains their technology choices. This is the official explanation for their technology choices. So if you come up to me afterwards and you say, well, I was talking with an Amish person and he said that cell phones are evil, okay, whatever. But actually, on a more formal way, in a more traditional way, the Amish make decisions is, okay, here's a bit of technology. Is this going to drive a wedge between us? Is this going to make our family stronger? Or is it going to break us apart? We could buy a dishwasher. But we'd rather all of us stand together at the sink and wash dishes together. Yeah, we could hire somebody, the great carpenters, we could just hire somebody to build a barn, but we'd rather all come together as a community with our kids playing in the field and all of us men working here and the women, you know, doing their, right? We're a community. We all come together as a community. People say, why don't, you know, they'll hire somebody to drive them in a bus, why don't they just drive the bus together? Because it is essential that everybody understand that dependency is a good thing. Americans strive to be independent. The Amish say, no, independency is a mirage. It's okay to be dependent. So we are dependent on other people to live. That's a good thing. We want our children to understand that. This is discipleship. This is discipleship, not the mere conveying of information. Learning this way requires discipleship. It is built on discipleship, okay? Let me give you two instances of how this happens, two little instances. One, actually, you'll recognize both of them. The first one is this. Anybody ever been to the Mennonite Museum in Holmes County, Ohio? Okay, this is a display on the museum. As I understand it, so many ACs went to visit this that they added an AC veil. This is an AC veil right here. Okay? Okay, but these are all, if you look at them, you're just like, man, they're all bonnets. Why you just have like one or two up there? No. If you look at them carefully, there are small differences between them. And I guarantee you, you ask the average 8-year-old girl in an Amish community, if I wore one of these, who would I be? She'd be able to tell you. Not because somebody set this in front of her and said, these people are of this affiliation, Old Order Amish, this affiliation in this city, or this area, and this is this. No, nobody ever did that. She learned it. She learned it by living with her parents, living in that community, and picking up the subtle differences. Okay? Now, what is really amazing to me is, and this is a sociological statement here. Sociologists point to this sort of thing, and they will say this lends itself to a very powerful sense of belonging and identity. Belonging and identity. Amish children have a powerful sense of who they are and where they belong. They are not floating free will out in space somewhere. They have a place in this world. Okay, and they know that place for good and for bad. They know their place. How about this? This is a funeral. I tried to get a picture of them. Okay, you all remember Nickel Mines shooting in 2006? Where a guy came into an Amish school and you know the story, right? Killed several of them, several little girls and Amish girls and that sort of thing. That day, the elders, including, as I understand it, including one of the dads of the girls who were shot, that very day went to the wife's house. The man ended up shooting himself as well. They went to the widow's house and said, we want you to know we are here for you. We have forgiven him. That is what they mean by Golasinheit. Why did God bring this into our life? We don't know. But he let it, so we are going to let it be here in our life, and we're going to deal with it. All right, that same day, they forgave this man for what this guy did. Now, it's more complicated than that. They're human beings. And I know for certain it took a while they're still working through it. Okay, they're still processing all of this. I know that. They are. I've heard it. They're still processing through this. Okay, this is actually on their way to one of their kids' funerals. As I understand it, they did the same thing when the shooter was buried. They showed up at the shooter's funeral, and you know what? Most people know. Actually, I don't know if most people do know. Do you realize that you're never supposed to take a picture of an Amish person? Like, that's just rude. That's just absolutely rude. Do not take pictures of Amish people. They don't like it, okay? But as I understand it, I couldn't find a picture picture of this. But as I understand it, at the shooter's funeral, they formed a ring around the family and faced outward towards the cameras in order to shield the family from all the press people, all right, all the press vultures that show up for a good picture. Isn't that powerful? Okay, now why did they do that? Why did they, like hours after the shooting, why did they show up there? Because forgiveness and Golasinheit is built into them. Not so much by telling people, you know, if this happens to you, you need to forgive. No. It's the way they live their life on a daily basis. It is built into them. I tried to find this quote, great quote. Man, I'm sorry. Great quote. Let me just leave you with this next 10 slides. A great quote, I couldn't find it, but somebody asked the child, how do you know how to be Amish? And she said, nobody ever really tells me, you just learn it. You learn by living in community, being discipled by everybody around you. Now, is this effective? Very high rates of generational continuity. Extremely high rates of generational continuity. They have very few children leave the Amish fold. Okay, it is one of the fastest growing, maybe the fastest growing religious group in the United States right now. They're just like doubling every so many years, in part because they have a lot of kids. And this is not just because of discipleship. It's not just because of discipleship. There's other reasons why they're growing so quickly. And there are dangers. Now here, because this is near and dear to my heart, I am gonna get personal. I'm gonna just tell you personally, there's a danger to this kind of thing as well. Okay? My own experience, I had a good friend, very dear friend, not an AC, started attending the Apostolic Christian Church in Altadena, where I was born and raised. And we became very close friends, and he converted, he was baptized in our church and everything. But I remember one day, I remember distinctly, we showed up at wherever we were going. I parked the car. We had been talking about some stuff, and he goes, "You know what, Fred? I just sense there's things about being an AC that I just don't understand. And it's hard for me to know all the time what's supposed to happen." And you know what? I was kind of proud of that. And I remember telling him, yeah, well, stick with me. You know, you'll learn it. You'll learn it over time. You know what? At that time, I had a very strong apostolic Christian identity, similar to the Amish. I value that tremendously because I see nothing like that in my students, in my college students. They have very, very little sense of identity or belonging. They are free-floating, and free-floating is freaking scaring them to death, literally. So I value that. It's powerful. It's also dangerous. Because it's exclusive. It can be way too exclusive. You know what I'm saying? So anyway, that's just a little comment there. So the early church grew rapidly using rigorous comprehensive type of the whole convert. I'm going to come to go fast here. McCraney is a famous example of how one person's type of others to close labor like you can have predominantly in the church, and conservative is an example of how the type can be extremely effective communicating non-data. I think you have that in your notes, which is why I read it really fast. Last thing is, you can just go through these. Paul reasoning through scriptures, that's discipleship. I'm of Apollos. Did you know that some New Testament scholars believe that he's speaking of a rabbi-disciple relationship here? Okay, it wasn't just like, oh, I like this church, this minister on the radio. Oh, I like this minister on the radio. No, these people were like forming like disciples around a rabbi. And Paul was like, well, it's okay, but don't identify like that. Anyway, but there was some sort of discipleship going on here. Monasteries, again, Augustine and Ambrose, very interesting story there about discipleship. Thank you very much.
I didn't really mean that. Thanks, Fred. And thanks so much. And I think just one piece here, just to consider and just to think about. He says somewhere along the line, he said, dependency is a good thing. Dependency is a good thing.
I did not say that. I said that Anabaptists.
The Anabaptists say dependency is a good thing. But I also think the scriptures, even from the very scripture that we read at the very beginning in Ephesians 4, speaks to this idea of how we, when we are called into a body, there will be an interdependence about that. In fact, that language of body is used, right, often to describe the church of God. Christ is the head from which all things emanate and flow. But then we're not just associated. We're not just members of a club, right? We are interdependent members one of another. And you see that countercultural message then play out throughout the history of the church in so many ways, echoed in this idea of discipleship. And so it is part of our identity, and I want to encourage you in that. It's been part of our identity for a long period of time. So thank you, Fred, so much for that.